Automakers are rolling out their 2010 lineup. These new offerings come at a critical moment, especially for American automakers who are still struggling to gain traction. To find out more, we reached Michelle Krebs. She's senior analyst at the auto information website, Edmunds.com. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, GM and Chrysler obviously have quite a lot at stake. They've emerged from bankruptcy. Their ability to survive could really hinge on their ability to sell cars this coming year. What have they got for 2010?
General Motors actually has quite a lot. They have a new sedan that they're positioning against the Lexus and Acura models, the Buick LaCrosse. Cadillac's got a new crossover called the SRX, and they are expanding the successful CTS line with a coupe and a station wagon. And then Chevy is going to be really important to the future of General Motors. They actually have come out with the 2010 Chevrolet Equinox, which replaces a previous crossover.
Now Chrysler, what about Chrysler?
Now Chrysler's got basically not very much. Chrysler was purchased in largely by Fiat, and so they are still sorting out what do they do about a future product plan, because one of the problems with Chrysler is they just didn't have a very full product pipeline. About the only big thing they've got coming is the 2011 Jeep Grand Cherokee, and that's hitting at the market when SUVs have fallen out of favor. So it's going to be a very tough and dry 18 months or 2 years for Chrysler.
Well, in broader terms, how are they looking? I mean, good enough to make it?
I think Chrysler is still iffy. We still don't know how this Fiat deal will go. I think GM will make it, but, you know, they're getting rid of Saab and Saturn and Hummer, and they're going to focus on four brands here in the United States. So it's probably going to be a much smaller General Motors.
What about Ford? Ford has been, relatively speaking, on a roll.
Absolutely. Now, let's remember, Ford still is not making money. But Ford's got a lot of interesting product, and they have been the beneficiary of not taking federal funds. You hear from consumers all the time, I bought a Ford because they didn't take federal money.
And that's because that's not a moral comment. That has to do with what they trust them more?
Well, I'm not so sure it isn't a moral comment. I think that there was a lot of resentment. The majority of Americans did not favor the government bailout of General Motors and Chrysler, and so that helped Ford. Now, Ford also, to its credit, had a lot of positive products. They've got the Ford Fusion that continues to be on the roll. The old Ford Focus just keeps churning them out. And they've got the new Ford Taurus coming out, which, by the way, is not your grandfather's Taurus. It's a completely new car, fabulous interior. They're bringing a lot of their European vehicles, which actually they're European design, but they'll be built in the U.S. For example, the Ford Fiesta is a really exciting new small car that will be coming from Europe, but they'll be building it here in Detroit.
Now, as you described it, there are significantly fewer offerings for various reasons. Is this a sign of things to come?
Well, there was a lot of scaling back during the recession of overall production and scaling back of cost spending on a future product. So we're going to be reaping some of that. But in the future, we're going to see a lot more small offerings. Through this Cash for Clunkers program, we saw people opting for smaller vehicles like small cars, mid-sized cars, little crossovers, sort of like small SUVs. That is definitely a trend for the future.
Michelle, thanks very much.
Glad to be with you. Thank you.
Michelle Krebs is a senior industry analyst with the consumer auto information website, Edmunds.com.
The nation's poverty rate is rising. The latest figures just released this hour show that 39.8 million people are below the official poverty line, and there are millions more just above that income level who are still struggling to get by, as we're going to hear this morning. The 2008 poverty rate stood at 13.2%. which is a bit higher and, in fact, the highest poverty rate in 10 years. The government measures poverty the same way it did more than 40 years ago, though, and some experts think that's a problem. They think it gives us an inaccurate picture, NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
It's not easy trying to define who is or isn't poor. Take Sandra Collette, a divorced mother of two who lives in Harlem.
When you're in a crisis with your family and you don't have the financial means to resolve that, I call that poverty.
She's walking home from a job she recently got at a foster care agency. It pays $29,000, which puts her well above the federal poverty line. But Collette, a very upbeat New Yorker, is still struggling. In fact, she isn't doing all that much better than when she was unemployed and eligible for more government benefits.
You know, you get the job and it's like, oh boy, breathing room. And so I said to my son, well, you know, it's still tight. It ain't tight.
Colette lives in one of the most expensive cities in the world, but the federal poverty measure doesn't take that into account. It's the same whether you're in New York or North Dakota. Colette lives in a two-bedroom apartment where her rent is subsidized. She pays $600 a month. The going rate is more than twice that amount.
I think it's about 56 apartments in here. Mixed income. Watch yourself.
She isn't considered poor by federal standards, in part because the poverty line was created back in the 1960s. At the time, Americans spent about a third of their income on food. So the government simply took the cost of a basic food plan and multiplied it by three. Since then, the poverty line's been adjusted for inflation. But that's it. Even though Americans today spend far less of their income on food and far more on other things, such as health care.
We quickly realized that we needed a more up-to-date and accurate measure.
Linda Gibbs is New York City's deputy mayor for Health and Human Services. She says the aha moment came when the city found a new way to help low-income residents take advantage of something called the Earned Income Tax Credit, a significant benefit for the poor.
And so the mayor is very excited. This is great. How much is this going to reduce poverty? And I had to say, well, not at all. Because the Earned Income Tax Credit as a tax refund is not counted in the income in a household.
That's because the official poverty rate only looks at income before taxes. So New York City decided to do what many experts are pushing the federal government to do, change the way it measures poverty to better reflect today's world. Let's go back to Sandra Colette.
Okay, so where are you? Where's your brother? All right, bye-bye. Okay, they are with their friends, and they're not coming back. They're in Midtown.
Colette uses her cell phone to keep track of her 16 and 14-year-old sons. For her, a cell phone's a necessity, and New York agrees. It includes the cost of phones as well as other utilities in calculating its poverty line. It also includes basic housing, food, and clothing costs. It then compares that amount to a family's after-tax income, plus the value of any government benefits such as food stamps. Then it subtracts medical costs. Sandra Colette checks her records to see how much is taken from her paycheck for premiums.
Here it is, $72.11 for dental and $190.32 for health.
Almost $7,000 a year, in addition to other out-of-pocket health costs. Colette doesn't pay to commute. She walks to work. But commuting and other work-related expenses are also taken into account in New York's poverty measure, which makes a lot of sense to Tony Santiago, a single mother of three.
This is exactly what Friday traffic is like.
Santiago drives between her Manhattan job and her Brooklyn home. Right now, she's stuck in a backup on the FDR Drive. The commute takes a slice out of her paycheck.
If I just go straight to work and straight home, I spend about $60 a week. So $240 rounded up to like $250 a month in gas alone.
She drives because her children get free daycare right near her job. She used to pay more than $150 a week. Childcare is another expense New York looks at in determining poverty. Santiago's $36,000 salary puts her well above the federal poverty line, $22,000 for a family of four. Still, she just filed for bankruptcy, so she doesn't understand why she isn't considered poor. Someone on the roof of Santiago's building in Brooklyn is throwing water balloons at the children playing below on a hot summer day. Inside, the elevator smells faintly of urine. Santiago and her children, ages 7, 10, and 16, share a two-bedroom apartment. The rooms here are dark and sparsely furnished, but paying just $800 a month rent helps Santiago to make ends meet.
I consider myself to be poor because once I pay rent, then I come home, I have to pay bills. I mean, I don't have like the little luxury amenities as far as like washer, dryer. Even though it sounds minor, it all adds up.
It's not a measure that tells you nothing, but it answers only a limited set of questions.
Rebecca Blank is Undersecretary for Economic Affairs at the Commerce Department, which produces the poverty rate. She says it shows how job-related income fluctuates, important in a recession.
What this won't show you, which is quite important, is the extent to which federal programs might buffer the loss of cash income. So some people who lose their job are going to get more food stamps income. Some of them are going to be able to claim more earned income tax credit income.
She says her agency is trying to find better ways to analyze how those programs affect poverty, but Blank doesn't expect the official measure to go away anytime soon. It's used to determine eligibility for programs such as Medicaid, and changing it is not only complicated but political. There are bound to be winners and losers. New York's alternative, for example, produced a lower poverty rate for single-parent families with children and a higher rate for the elderly.
There's a big constituency now for inertia on this thing.
Nicholas Eberstadt is a researcher at the American Enterprise Institute. He says everyone wants to know how changing the formula affects them. As a result, most of the proposals to update the measure, at least initially, would not affect eligibility for programs, but would be used instead, as in New York, to help shape policy. Eberstadt thinks something needs to be done soon.
I'm very worried that our existing poverty rate is a broken compass, and it's just going to misguide us. And now, of all times, while we're in the middle of a big global economic crisis, we need to have good instrumentation to inform us about who's in need.
Sandra Collette of Harlem couldn't agree more.
I'm so confused about what's poor and what's not poor. You know, and I have to keep going back and saying, if you knew your basics were covered, maybe I wouldn't consider myself to be poor.
But she knows for her and many others, they're not covered, no matter what the official numbers say. Pam Fessler, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The U.S. poverty rate hit its highest level in 11 years in 2008. That's according to new numbers released today by the Census Bureau. The census counted almost 40 million people living in poverty in what was the first year of the recession. NPR's Pam Fester reports.
The fact that poverty's on the rise is no surprise. With the start of the recession back in December 2007, unemployment has been going up and incomes going down. The median income dropped 3.6% last year, and the poverty rate rose to 13.2%. That pushed an additional 2.5 million people below the poverty line. Many were children. David Johnson, a senior statistician with the Census Bureau, said the increase is clearly linked to jobs.
Children in non-working families, children in female-headed households, children in families that receive food stamps, their poverty rate didn't change much, whereas children in earner households, the poverty was affected a lot. So you see a lot of it tied to the earnings change in 2007-2008.
Which makes a lot of people nervous. If things were so bad last year, what about now?
These numbers are grim, grimmer than we'd expected.
Robert Greenstein heads the Liberal Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. He knows that joblessness has only continued to rise.
This creates a very serious concern that if we already were at just under 40 million Americans in poverty in 2008, before the biggest increases in unemployment, poverty is going to go much higher than that in 2009 and 2010.
In fact, he predicts it could go higher than it's been in 50 years. The view from Ron Haskins of the Brookings Institution isn't much brighter. He's a Republican who was instrumental in the welfare overhaul of the 1990s. Haskins thinks that today's numbers show the country's in the midst of an extended period of bad news.
We're in an era, I think, of several years of fairly serious poverty levels, and especially if you compare it with the late 1990s, because that was a wonderful time for poverty. Way more people worked, in part because of welfare reform.
He says the problem now is that the jobs just aren't there, and the prospects for future job growth aren't good. Haskins notes that almost all segments of the population have been affected, except the elderly, who didn't experience a significant increase in poverty last year.
All over the country, married couple families, middle class, low income, single parent families, except the elderly, poverty increased for almost every group. So it's a very widespread phenomenon.
Although the poverty rate did remain unchanged for blacks, Johnson of the Census Bureau said it's not clear why, but he noted that blacks already had a very high poverty rate, almost 25% last year, compared with 8.6% for non-Hispanic whites. Poverty among Hispanics rose by 2 percentage points to more than 23%.
There has been some criticism recently of how the government measures poverty, and Johnson said the Census Bureau will be producing some alternative statistics later this year. He said, for example, if food stamps are factored into the poverty numbers, more than 2 million fewer people would be considered poor. But Haskins says by any measure, poverty is on the rise. And of course, that's not news to people on the front lines. George Jones runs Bread for the City in Washington, D.C., a nonprofit that provides food, clothing, and other services to the poor. He says the lines there keep getting longer and longer.
When the economy really started to sort of falter, we were seeing an uptick of about 10% increase of food clients over the course of a 12-month period. So two consecutive years, we saw that level of growth.
And it's been the same across the country. What has Jones concerned now is that he's only beginning to see the next wave of the newly poor. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
This week, Colorado became the latest state to furlough government workers. At least 20 states have imposed furloughs to save money or are considering doing so, and many private companies have done the same. But do furloughs actually save money? California has the biggest budget crisis in the country, and it's been furloughing state workers since February. Rachel Dornhelm reports on the debate there over the true savings.
On a recent Friday near California's Capitol building, things are quiet. It's a furlough day, one of three a month, and across the state, almost 200,000 state workers are taking a forced day off. That's supposed to help shave $1.3 billion off the state's budget this year. But the costs to the state may offset a lot of the savings. Gabriel Taylor, an engineer for a state agency, explains how the furlough days affect his budget.
In theory, it's a 14% pay cut, but in practice for me, it seems a lot more than that because my fixed costs, you know, my mortgage, my food and whatnot, account for a fair amount of my monthly income, and this comes off of the excess of that. So it's cut my disposable income, so to speak, down by about 50%.
He's not going out to eat as much. He's putting off a home remodeling project he'd been planning for some time. His decision to cut spending costs the state money in lost taxes, and it hurts small businesses. Here at Sacramento's Kabul Kebab Cuisine, a sign in the window reads, "When state workers lose, we lose." Owner Hemyat Suez says Fridays used to be his busiest time, but ever since the furloughs...
Fridays business is down something like 50 to 60%.
And the rest of the week?
It's the same. We see something like 20, 30% down.
In addition to lost spending and tax revenue, there are the costs to the state from service disruptions. Some are obvious. People taking more time off private sector jobs because of longer wait times at public offices like the DMV. Then there are blips, like a truck spilling wine cork lubricant all over a Northern California freeway.
So there was a two-hour delay in sending up cleanup crews. Overall, it ended up taking 12 hours to clean up.
That's Ken Jacobs, chair of the UC Berkeley Center on Labor Research and Education.
But again, the spill took place on a Friday. It was furlough Friday. There was no one to go out. And all of those delays are an economic cost to the state.
He says the furloughs also cost the state money directly when agencies that generate revenue shut down, to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. At the same time, there are savings from shutting down state buildings for what will be the equivalent of 7 weeks this year. John Sullivan is a skeptic. He's at San Francisco State University and has analyzed the effect of furloughs at some private firms. He says furloughs can end up costing companies about double what they set out to save, from lost productivity, poor morale, and poor quality control. Most important, companies run the risk of losing their best workers.
And so what you want to do is just like if you had a cancer, you don't really want to cut off 10% of your whole body. You want to target on the cancer.
He says focused layoffs would be a better solution. But not always. Professor David Levine at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business says some furloughs can be very effective, especially when company leadership makes a good case for the belt tightening and are making sacrifices too.
The main thing that managers have to think about is just that the communication is clear and credible so that they're not destroying what in most companies is much more valuable than the plant and equipment, which is the skills and commitment of their workforce.
Furloughs may be a better option than layoffs, says Levine. When the economy recovers, your workforce is still there. Still, hard numbers on the bottom line are difficult to come by. Berkeley labor researcher Ken Jacobs says few economists have looked at this.
Do you think that will change now?
I suspect having gone through this economic downturn, now that there will be quite a bit of data about what happened, I expect this will keep economists busy for a while.
Jacobs says he's already at work with colleagues on the question. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Dornhelm.